I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show that addresses issues of the heart as well as issues of the mind. Tonight we'll be exploring the complex subject of domestic violence. And with me in the studio is Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, Director of AWARE, which stands for Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies. Welcome, Sarah Lynn. Yeah.
Good to be here.
You've been the AWARE director for many years. How long has it been?
It's been 11 years.
Wow. Okay. I've never asked you this question, but I've always been curious. What led you to become professionally involved in the field of domestic violence?
You know, Elaine, I started in graduate school in Pittsburgh when I was working on my master's degree. And I had an internship working with kids, and kids was really my forte at that time. I worked subsequently at Pittsburgh Action Against Rape, and I worked with kids who'd been sexually abused, did play therapy and counseling, and also worked with supportive parents. And from that became interested in ending violence against women and children and domestic violence. When I left Pittsburgh. I was in Seattle for a few years, volunteered at a shelter there.
Which one?
New Beginnings.
New Beginnings. Jenny McCarthy's.
There you go.
That. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I was there about 2 years, and there was a job advertised for a counselor for children in Juneau at AWARE. That's brought me to AWARE over 25 years ago.
Oh, 25 years. So have you worked at AWARE for 25 years?
Believe it or not. Yes.
You came in right after, I mean, somewhat soon after I left, because I moved here 30 years ago. And although I had a private practice, I worked half-time at AWARE to develop their rape crisis center. Because, interestingly, that's what I was doing in Seattle. As part of my graduate work, I had a community placement where we started rape relief,
Seattle Rape Relief. Right, I remember.
Four of us started Seattle Rape Relief. So it's, I think, one of the better things we did back then when everything was just beginning and just happening.
Right, right, right.
So what was your first job at AWARE?
My first job, I did counseling with children.
Okay.
And worked with the children's program at AWARE.
Okay, great. I know that a lot of people are a little confused about the parameters of what we call domestic violence. How do you define it?
Thanks for asking, Elaine, because I think a lot of people wonder, you know, they think of domestic violence and think that they're going to see bruises or some outwardly apparent way of knowing that somebody has been a victim or a perpetrator. You can tell by looking at them, and of course you can't. Domestic violence is a pattern of behavior, and it's a pattern where one person uses power and control to get another person in an intimate relationship to do what they want them to do, to think how they want them to think, to behave how they want them to behave. So really, using control tactics and power to get what they want.
And so for tonight's discussion, it sounds like we're going to leave out physical violence against children, perhaps, and really focus on partner abuse. But we will talk about the impact on children, too.
Sure.
I think that's very important. I want to tell our listeners that you can call us at any time during this one-hour show. Just call 463-6433, and we'll get you on the air. If you don't want your voice on the air, feel free to talk to our operator who'll pick up the phone. And if you have a comment or a question, anything about domestic violence, they can write it down. Otherwise, we'd love to get your own voice on the air. So don't be shy. Give us a call with your own ideas or perhaps experience of domestic violence at 463-6433. Sarah Lynn, were you going to say something more?
I wanted to tell people a little bit, you know, when you ask what is domestic violence, I wanted to let people know what it looked like, because we know what it doesn't look like necessarily. So what does domestic violence look like? There are tactics that people who abuse power use to get someone to do what they want them to do. So, for example, one tactic might be emotional abuse, name-calling, putting someone down, telling someone you're a terrible mother, you will never get custody of these kids. If you leave me, I will get custody. So you can see over there, then there's also a threat that's involved there, which is another tactic, as well as using children as a tactic. So, for example, coming home and saying to a child, was your mom here when you got home from school? Well, what time did she get home? Did she call anybody? Who did she call? How long was she on the phone? Really using children for surveillance, which is a terrible place to put children
in
the middle.
And that would be in order to control their spouse, to find out all where they are.
Right.
Okay.
Where they are, what they're doing. Isolation, which is a huge factor. And domestic violence almost always begins with emotional abuse and isolation. Here's the thing. If someone's telling me I'm stupid, fat, and ugly all the time, if I am out in the world and you say to me, hey, Sarah Lynn, you did a great job on this, whatever, you're pretty smart, then I'm getting a different message. But if I'm in isolation and the only message I'm getting is that I'm stupid, fat, and ugly, I come to believe that. Mm-hmm. So, for example, prisoners of war are brainwashed using just emotional abuse and isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes people wonder, well, how does someone become isolated? And it can be very subtle. So, for example, maybe I am going out with a guy, and he's my boyfriend, and I go out with my girlfriends. And when I come home, he says to me, you know, Sarah Lynn, I'm not really sure why you're hanging out with those women. They're really not your friends. And he might use some derogatory terms to describe them and assure you want to be hanging out with them. Maybe he's mopey. Maybe I start to pull back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's a warning sign as well to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've noticed is when I work clinically with couples who are in any kind of abusive situation, they also don't have couple friends. They don't have peer friends because all I can think of is they don't, like, let's say the wife is being emotionally abused or the husband is being verbally abused. They don't want to bring anybody into that environment because they're afraid it'll slip out and they're ashamed. So even the victim is ashamed and doesn't want anybody around. Then, think of this, then they have kids. And I have had many, a child tell me, as well as adults who grew up in abusive families or alcoholic families, I didn't want to bring any of my friends home. I was embarrassed.
Right.
My friends are scared of my dad. That kind of thing.
Right.
So that further isolates the family.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there can be things like economic abuse. So, for example, you know, counting every penny, where the money goes, using money to buy drugs or alcohol versus pay the rent or buy food. You know, I'll never forget a woman who came into Aware and she said that her husband bought a boat. She came home one day and there was a boat in the driveway. So he made this unilateral decision and it was her job to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And there really was not enough income to pay all the bills.
Right, right.
Yeah. So,
is that anything more you want to add on that?
Oh, we could go on and on.
Okay. So, what we're taking a look at are, say, three subcategories. It would be the obvious physical abuse, then verbal abuse. We haven't, but the verbal abuse, what I say to clients when I'm working with families or couples, I define verbal abuse as shouting or yelling, whatever you're shouting or yelling, or using derogatory language or expletives, that I consider that verbal abuse. What I'm noticing now is how common it's becoming to use expletives, especially ones that are sort of like swear words, like the F word, but not quite, and that it's getting more into day-to-day parlance, like even the word shut up. That kids will say shut up to their parents, and the parents don't bat an eye. They don't think it's harsh. And what do you think about that? What I've had people say, well, everybody talks like that. I personally feel it's still harmful.
Right. I mean, that's the problem. Everybody talks like that.
Yeah.
So in certain circles, everybody talks like that.
Right.
In other circles, you know, people don't talk like that. And it's alarming to people who don't talk like that, aren't used to that, and come into an environment where voices are raised.
Yes. And I guess then the big question is, what would make a person vulnerable to becoming a victim of domestic violence, to marrying or partnering with someone who physically or psychologically or verbally abuses them? What makes you vulnerable to that?
You know, the first thing that makes people vulnerable, believe it or not, is being a woman. Because domestic violence is something that primarily impacts women as victims. Women are more vulnerable largely because of the culture that we live in.
Yeah.
So in this culture, women are raised to be caretakers, to put other needs first, that they're not as important as the next person, and to be of service to others. Women's vulnerability and ability to forgive. So if someone oversteps a boundary, they may feel like, oh, he didn't really mean it, or I should give him another chance.
Socialized to be more generous. How interesting. Socialized to forgive. That women are likely to
be polite.
To be polite.
Right.
To forgive.
Not hurt
to
feelings.
To let go. Not hurt other people's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it really can set women up to not be able to speak up for themselves and to be assertive and to recognize this doesn't feel right, or to recognize this doesn't feel right, but to not totally trust that.
Okay.
So to continue with a relationship that they're not certain about.
Yeah. And to further talk about vulnerability, because half of us are born women.
Right.
But not half of us become involved with an abusive partner.
Right.
So why do some women, but not others, end up in abusive relationships?
Great question. There are other factors. So, for example, the factor of being, you know, children are vulnerable. So if as a child we are respected, our needs are recognized and met, our wishes are recognized, our feelings are acknowledged and allowed to be, that's really helpful. And I mean, you know, that's
of
healthy
course.
Growing.
Right.
If, on the other hand, our personal bubbles, if you will, you know, what's our space, if that's invaded time and again, and I'm talking, for example, about child abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, growing up in violence, where personal boundaries are not respected, not recognized. I mean, I've had adults say to me, what if you don't know what your boundaries are?
Exactly.
Because they have no idea.
Right.
So that also makes people more vulnerable because they don't necessarily recognize that this behavior is unacceptable.
Well, both of you and I are familiar with the ACEs study, and I've had two radio shows basically addressing the ACEs study, and that study took a huge population from Kaiser Permanente, and it took a look at adverse childhood experiences, which is what ACE stands for, and there were 10, I remember, and summarized 10 experiences. And of course, one of them was growing up in an abusive family, including alcoholism, verbal abuse, parent being incarcerated, being molested. And the higher the number that people checked off, the more likely they were to be ill, to live a shorter life, to have serious mental health and physical health problems. It shortened their lifespan, and it degraded their life in direct correlation to the number of adverse childhood experiences they had checked off. And so I think what you're saying is not only would a child who's growing up in an abusive home suffer the effects of their childhood, but they are more likely to live and choose a partner who is abusive to them, or perhaps be a perpetrator of the abuse.
Yeah, you know, children grow up in homes, and if there's violence in a home, maybe there's two brothers and two sisters. One brother will be abusive, one brother will not be abusive, one sister will be in an abuse, one not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is learned behavior.
Yeah.
So the beautiful thing is it can be unlearned.
Yes.
And at the same time, it's throughout our culture. You know, it's not just in our families. It's in the media. It's in movies, magazines, songs.
And it's in war. Because
yes.
Soldiers coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, and this was true for Vietnam, soldiers who come back who have just been in a situation where violence is the norm, and as we know now from atrocity situations that are being investigated, unfortunately, the violence is not limited to combatants. We have soldiers coming back who, on their conscience, have the horror of having seen themselves shoot children, grandparents, and total noncombatants. And they come home, and the incidence of domestic violence, as far as I know, is skyrocketing on military bases.
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because just today I saw a video with Patrick Stewart. You know who that is?
Yeah.
Okay. So he's an actor, captain.
Yeah. Yeah. Movie star. Yeah.
Star Trek.
Yeah.
He was speaking because he grew up in a family where domestic violence, his father was abusive to his mother.
Oh.
So in the United Kingdom, he is very active and has been very active for many years in supporting Refuge is the name of the program for shelter and safety, he repeated, for women and children who are victims of domestic violence. As he was talking, he said that last year, he found out by reading some writings of his father that from 1940, that his father was diagnosed with severe shell shock.
Oh.
Coming back from war.
From World War II. PTSD, we call it now.
Exactly.
Used to call
exactly.
it shell shock. In World War I, they called it shell shock. Absolutely.
Yeah. And he said that now, since that time, he's taken on, you know, in his mother's honor, he works with domestic violence, and now in his father's honor, he works with soldiers returning home.
Oh, how wonderful.
Money. Yeah.
And,
so
look, and you know, later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the cultural underpinnings that may be unique to America, maybe not. But one thing that is a very sad fact about life in America is that America goes to war. And it goes to war with huge numbers of people. So what a price we pay for our military actions that are the violence is brought home.
Yes.
And it isn't just over there. It's back here. What about perpetrators? Or is there another word you would prefer to use? Abusers? The individuals who are the abusers, not the victims.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the risk factor would be being born male.
You know, the culture is, there are burdens for both women and men. The expectations that are set out for how we should behave, what we should do. You know, it's called the girl box and the boy box. So if a boy, you know, boys don't cry. And what happens if a boy cries? He's called a sissy. He's called names that
we all know.
Right. So there is a certain standard of expectation that our culture puts on boys of how to behave, act like a man, whatever that means. You know, we don't say what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to think of you might wonder why a young woman coming out of an abusive situation would pick a young man who is also coming out of an abusive situation. They have a lot in common. In fact, in high school dating today in this town, there are abusive relationships. So I always look at it a bit this way when I'm working with couples. People of about the same level of emotional wellness are attracted to people of about the same wellness same level of emotional wellness. And even though on paper it may look opposite, but they would both, let's take the case of domestic violence. You need a victim and you need a perpetrator, and the roles may go back and forth sometimes. Okay? It's not like everybody's always, the one person is always the victim. Because, of course, I work where it gets a little complex, too, because there's verbal abuse coming maybe from the wife and physical abuse coming from the husband. But you've got a situation where they will both probably have extremely low self-esteem because they wouldn't be acting that way. She wouldn't have been attracted to him. She wouldn't have stayed in the relationship. I remember I work with eating disorders, and I remember working with a woman who was anorexic. And she was a teenager, and she was dating a guy who used to berate her and say she had a fat this and a fat that. Then I found out that he was a hyper workout kind of guy, and that was his mode of masculinity, to be an extreme, I would say, extreme athlete. It was very interesting to see. And then it turned out he also came from a family that had a lot of pain in it, whole lot of pain in it.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people grow up with a lot of pain. And I think I'll never forget a woman who got out of an abusive relationship. And shortly thereafter, one of her, a male friend, came and wanted to start dating her. And she didn't want to date him. She recognized that she was vulnerable and that people take advantage of vulnerable people.
Yes.
So, you know, recognizing that a woman's out of an abusive relationship, men who abuse power and control find these women.
Absolutely.
And it really can put women at risk, which is why the intervention is so important.
And how do they find it? It's actually not mysterious, because when this young woman who I was treating, she was coming in for anorexia, when she told me what the boy said to her, I said, why would you go out with somebody who's so insulting? And to her, it was like totally normal. And I thought, boy, when I was 17, if anybody had insulted me like that, I know this, it would have been over, completely over.
Yeah.
And also, if you think about with sexual violence, what makes an incest? I work a lot with incest survivors. We call them survivors, by the way. It's kind of the PC term. But these are incest victims, and not all are survivors in a psychological sense. And they are very likely to be sexually exploited as they go along in their adult life by a teacher, by a professor. Boundaries. They don't, you know, what is my body? Right. What is going on? They've been treated as a sexual commodity growing up.
Yeah.
And they're much more likely to be vulnerable and victimized by men in a position of power using their position of power.
Yeah.
You know, to, you know, they may think they're exchanging it for favors.
Right. Right. You know, when women, I think, you know, the majority is that men are abusive.
The majority of abusers are men.
Yes. And there's abuse also happens in gay and lesbian relationships, and women can be abusive to men as well. I don't want to, you know, negate that at all. But I'm speaking more about men and women in those terms, because that's the actuality. Often women, you know, one thing, again, Patrick Stewart said is, he said, the police would come to his home when he was a child, and they would say to his mother, what did you do to provoke him? You must have done something.
Yes.
And he said, my mother did absolutely nothing. She did absolutely nothing, and no matter what she did, even if she did something, it would never have been okay for my father to hit her.
And Patrick Stewart got it. But what the police didn't get is there is no excuse for violence.
Right.
None. Ever. Zero. And so the idea that she burnt the pork chops, or she flirted with my best friend, or she did something, isn't that probably in treatment? We'll get into treatment later, but the breakthrough in treatment. And I work with this at a less dramatic level. I'll work with forms of verbal abuse, you know, when I'm working with couples who come in for couple counseling, because you'd never do start couple counseling when there's a case of domestic violence, at least in my opinion.
Right.
You work
Thank
with
you
the offender.
Saying.
Okay,
and
but we'll... Yeah. So what I talk about is there is never any reason to be verbally abusive or to be physically abusive. Zero. And here's what's interesting where it connects to the family of origin. They grew up in a family that used no other means to communicate or to discipline the children. And so other than verbal abuse or physical abuse as a form of discipline. So you learn to be an abuser because you don't have a repertoire. So what I do in counseling is to hopefully encourage them to teach them a repertoire of other behaviors.
Right.
That they can use to get their point across.
Right. Because, you know, what's happening? People are trying to get their needs met, but the strategies they're using are not, number one, they're not helpful. And sometimes they work is why they can continue to use an abusive strategy, but it really harms the relationship and it doesn't meet the long-term goals that they want. Which is what? To be in a loving relationship.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to remind our listeners, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and I'm in the K2 studio tonight with Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, who is an expert on domestic violence. You can call us anytime during this one-hour show. So we'll be here till 8 o'clock. You can call 463-6433, and we'll get you on the air. So... please, if you have any comments or experiences you wish to share, call us at 463-6433. Now we're going to play a song that was chosen by a friend of mine when I told her what the program was about, and her name is Sue Schroeder, and this is a song that she thought might be appropriate for the program.
There's a friend who will call when her husband's asleep, crossing the phone lines for comfort. And she cries that she needs him, and someday he'll change, and now's not a good time to go. And it isn't my place to say leave him and run. No love is worth all the damage he's done, but she'll hold her ground, and I'll hold my tongue. Ever the diplomat. Oh, I'd like to think that I will be stronger than that. Where's her? Is all she deserves. Oh, I would be stronger. I wouldn't stay 1 minute longer. I would be stronger than that. Well, it started out good. They usually do. Then one day it's taken for granted. Become weapons and turn into pain. Oh, why is she still holding on? She said living without him is too hard to face. And I try to imagine myself in her place, but with well-chosen words and well-placed tears, she forgives him in 2 seconds flat. Oh, I'd like to think that I would be stronger than that. Well, I know what she's thinking, and I know what she'd say. And my life and hers are like night and like day. And her love, the love that we'll see.
was right on. Welcome back to our discussion about domestic violence. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio is Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, the director of the AWARE Shelter, as well as a clinical expert on treating domestic violence. Sarah Lynn, that song brought up, Why Do Women Stay? Could you shed some light on that, please?
Sure. You know, have you ever gone out on a date?
Yep.
And did you ever get punched in the face on a first date?
No.
No. Nobody ever does.
Oh.
Really.
Okay.
Okay. So you can see where I'm going.
You know,
on a first date, people are on their best behavior. On a second date, people are generally...
Still.
Yeah.
You haven't hooked them yet.
Right. Once somebody's hooked is then when abusive behaviors might begin. But it doesn't necessarily look abusive. Pardon me. It might look more like love, or at least explained as love.
Ah, like jealousy.
There you go.
Okay.
Right.
Like jealousy.
Yes.
Yeah. And so he really loves you because he's worried, and you must be very attractive. Maybe you are more attractive than you thought because he thinks all these men are looking at you.
And not only that, nobody has ever understood him like you do.
Yeah.
And nobody's ever loved him like you do. And he's never felt this way before.
Uh-huh.
This is
quite
special and extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have together is really something. So wouldn't you want to spend more time together?
Right.
Because it's pretty special.
And then?
And then.
So when it mounts, and he hasn't slugged her yet, but you're talking about a kind of inadvertent, unconscious grooming. We use the term grooming around perpetrators molesting children.
Right.
And having it move up sort of slowly. Of course, this isn't somebody who's purposely at the age of 18 grooming somebody. It is just they're being themselves. It's natural. And eventually, their worldview is that it's okay to slap somebody.
Could be, and it could also be grooming. Because how is it that they're able to be on good behavior for 3 months?
Well, they know that I'd say it's half unconscious. There's a part of them that knows that if they lose their temper too soon or get roaring drunk or whatever, they haven't bonded enough with the woman for her to stay.
Yeah. And which brings me to another, if I can sort of take a periphery here.
Sure.
But they haven't bonded with themselves. Same, you know, our most important relationship is with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're looking for something with someone else without relating to yourself, so knowing really, like, it's, do I even like this guy? I went out because he asked me out.
Right. And if you grow up in the kind of home you described so beautifully, where essentially you're a nobody, the home is disrupted, the home is perhaps violent, may not be violent, maybe a more abandonment or lack of parents around at all. Father could have left several kids behind. Mom is working day and night to make ends meet, and the children are growing up unnurtured. Unfortunately, the message an unnurtured child gets is, I don't matter.
Yeah.
And so if they don't matter, when somebody, and well, it could even be worse than I don't matter, because their older brother could be beating up on them, because if siblings are left without a parent in the house, wow, that can happen too. And even after the eighth date, if a boyfriend, and this happens because I work with it, gets upset, walks out of the room because he thinks that she was flirting with another boy.
Right.
And she wasn't. She forgives him. Whereas probably if she grew up in a healthy home, she'd think he was nuts and not be interested in him
it's
anymore.
Right, a different perspective.
Yeah.
Exactly, right.
And it's also what you're used to. I mean, if you grow up in a polluted city and the air is brown like it is in every city in China, if you've never been out of that city, you don't know air is clear.
Right.
And so when you're growing up in a family where harsh behavior is the norm. Let's just say the word shut up. Sounds innocuous in some ways, but I sure wasn't allowed to say shut up, nor were my kids allowed to say shut up. But if you grow up in that kind of environment, when your boyfriend talks to you that way, basically you're on the same wavelength.
Right.
See, if it's almost like your antenna are out, because you're really looking for somebody who shares your worldview, which is, it's okay if I slap you.
Could
you're not going to leave me.
Although there's also, you know, I mean, I know you see this as well, people who grow up with abuse who say, I will never let this happen to me, or I will never do this. And somehow they're able to bring this awareness and this consciousness to every move they make and their choices. And, I mean, it's incredible.
It is. And it's a thrilling miracle.
Yes.
And I have been actually thrilled at times where I have worked with somebody who's coming in for, let's say, normal marriage problems. They're in a decent marriage. They've got some, you know, problems, often because they come from such a difficult family that they don't know if they should have their impaired siblings move in with them.
Right.
Yeah, or something like that. And then I discover this terrible situation this individual grew up in, and they're fine.
Yes.
Why? Multiple factors.
Yeah, multiple factors. And a lot of awareness on their part, I think. Because, you know, we internalize what we grow up with. You kind of can't help that.
Yes.
So unless you have that ability to be aware and to use that awareness and that consciousness to make different choices or to say, wait, is this what I want? No, this is what I want to avoid. So I can avoid that.
And, you know, in the research on vulnerability, I did a program on resilience.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it's research on resilience. I had somebody visiting from out of town who had written a book on resilience, so I had to put him on the program, of course. And the biggest factor of kids who grow up in difficult situations but who survive and thrive, mentorship.
Having and someone who believed in them.
Yes.
Yes.
Having somebody who mentored them. It
mm-hmm.
could be a number of people
mm-hmm.
or one or two. The other thing is the survivors, the people who survived and thrived, tended to be bright and outgoing and attractive because that attracted mentors.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So not every, you could say, well, wouldn't everybody get a mentor? Well, not really. Because
uh-huh.
picture you're a fourth grade teacher, and you've got some poor bedraggled little kid who is absolutely adorable, bright as a whip, and you love being with them. You might choose that kid to mentor, you know, who's coming
right.
from a difficult situation.
Right, right, right.
I wanted to go back a little to growing up in a domestic violence, a physically abusive home, where let's just say the children aren't abused, technically. There's no physical abuse of children, maybe some yelling and screaming, but the mom and dad are at it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with some of the research that shows some of the neurological hardwired impacts that can come from that?
A lot of the times, we don't see moms and dads going at it all the time because moms are trying to mitigate things.
Mm.
So they're trying to keep things as calm as possible for the children primarily.
Mm-hmm.
When women may fight back, if you will, it's often to prevent something further from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really... I'll never forget this woman who said, Sarah Lynn, I am really smart, and I have tried everything I know to get this violence to stop, and I can't do it. Well, of course she can't do it. It has nothing to do with her.
Yes. Yes.
And but for children, right, it's very difficult. You know, you spoke earlier about growing up with fear. Some children think it's totally normal that you're supposed to be afraid of your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be afraid of your dad.
Right, right. And there are, there's been just an explosion of neuroscience research in the last 10, 15 years, and mainly because of some new instruments like the functional MRI. And what has been found is that children that grow up in homes with violence or abuse have different brains than kids who don't. Brains are growing so quickly. So what I do when I'm working with a couple that is just verbally abusive, no physical abuse, mm-hmm. and they're nice to their kids, I say that child, and I've got research to back it up, that is overhearing you as they're cowering in the bedroom, screaming and yelling at each other, even if it's not all the time,
yeah.
and periodically, so that's damaging their brain.
Yeah.
That's
so,
really harming them.
And, you know, Elaine, I'm not sure I would call that domestic violence. If you're talking about where there's not a power imbalance in the family.
Ah, very good.
Because if there's a power, because that's a
okay.
difference. Because
yes.
Because as you said, you wouldn't do counseling where there's domestic violence. And it's not the physical
mm-hmm.
violence that makes it domestic
no.
violence. It can be just, not even just, but it can be non-physical violence that can keep people terrorized.
Okay.
And then you wouldn't want to do couples counseling because if they came to you for couples counseling, the woman would either be afraid to tell the truth mm-hmm. because of the power imbalance, or if she told the truth, who knows what would happen to her when she got home.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't really yet fully explored the issue of why women stay. You did a great job of explaining the gradual way to hook
right.
and to get involved with an, while dating.
Right.
But after this next song, okay, let's talk about why a woman in the middle of the situation with maybe a couple of kids, maybe not with a couple of kids, still, just like the last song, doesn't want to leave.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late, if they come at all. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late, if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes. Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late, if they come at all.
Wow. That is some song, and that was one suggested by Sarah Lynn.
Yeah, thankfully that's many years old. Hopefully the story's different now. But I think there was actually a story on NPR about Oregon. Where did you happen to hear this on the radio?
What?
Where they didn't have enough funding to have law enforcement 24/7. And there was a terrible incident of violence that I mm-hmm. will not repeat, but that happened in the last couple weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Where there wasn't any law enforcement, the woman could
right.
call.
Right. The woman called 911. She was on the phone with the dispatcher, but nobody could. There was nobody.
Oh, my God. Let's talk about why women stay.
Yeah. Okay. So the reason why I talked about, you know, this doesn't happen on a first date is because women are building some investment in a partner.
Mm-hmm.
So when does abuse really start? It starts when the hook's in, just exactly as you said, Elaine. So when is the hook in? It's when the man thinks it's in. So it could be, like in teenage relationships, it's often after the first time they have sex.
Mm-hmm.
It could be after they're married, which is why you've heard women talk about their honeymoons being horrific. It could be after a child or when a woman is pregnant. So the man feels that the hook is there. So women have a lot of hope. They remember the early days. They have a lot of love. They want to believe that they can help this person. Sometimes they are financially dependent. They may have religious beliefs that tell them to stay. They may be, you know, it could be that their housing is fine, that they're a wealthy family, that they've worked hard to get what they have and don't want to lose that.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that their family does not support them. You made your bed.
No,
sleep lying. In it.
Right, right.
What about the children? What will happen to the children?
I've worked with women who are just absolutely torn because they say, what is more harmful to the children, to be in our home where violence breaks out or to be children of divorce? They really don't know what to do.
Right.
What's more harmful?
Right. I have an opinion about that, of course.
Yeah, I want to hear your opinion.
Well, my opinion about that is growing up with violence is very harmful. And if you can be in a loving home with one parent, that's great.
And you know what? I totally agree.
Yeah. You know, the other reason it's hard, there are times, too, that women choose to stay because that's the safest choice they can make. Elaine, if you listen to the radio and you hear about women who were murdered by their former partners or abusive partners or estranged partners, you will hear that they were separated, they were divorced or divorcing, they were estranged when he killed her and then killed himself and killed the children or whatever. But leaving is the most dangerous time.
Yes.
If you think about, you know, it's about power and having control over another person. So when a woman decides to leave, the offender, the perpetrator, is losing that power and control.
Mm-hmm.
So leaving doesn't always mean safety.
And this is where battered women's shelters first came in. We realized that in Seattle, where right at the time, and it must have been about 35 years ago, when the battered women's movement really started getting going. And what we realized was that, no, she couldn't just rent a motel room. We needed a safe house for her, a place where no one could find her and where she could get a restraining order if that was appropriate, and also where she could get some help.
Right.
Because simply leaving for many women, particularly in the worst cases where her partner is homicidal, but she doesn't ever know that for sure because there's always a first time. You don't have any guarantee just because he never killed her before, so to speak, doesn't mean he's not going to do it.
Right.
So when a woman's in that situation where she fears for her life, how is the AWARE shelter or any battered women's shelter able to be of assistance?
Of course, AWARE, you know, we offer safe shelter. So it's a safe place. So, and it's confidential. So if you were to call Elaine and say, hey, I think somebody, one of my clients is staying there, can I speak to her? The answer is, sorry, we can't say if she's here or not, unless she gives us permission.
I tried it. Yeah. What about everybody knows where the AWARE shelter is in town?
Right. So that's known in town. That's very true. And to get to the AWARE shelter or inside, you have to ring the doorbell. There are cameras all around. We have a pretty sophisticated security system, as you might imagine, because everyone does know where AWARE is. And if there's, we've had times where the police have shown up at AWARE in a matter of seconds, really.
They know. If they get a call from you, get over there.
Yeah.
Are restraining orders really valuable? Do they work?
Well, it depends. Sometimes they can be extremely helpful, but not necessarily. You know, there are some things that domestic violence situations have in common and some things that they don't. So if I get a restraining order against someone who doesn't want to go to jail or who wants to be a law-abiding citizen, it will probably work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a piece of paper. And at the same time, if someone comes to a wearer and says, can you help me with a protective order, we not only help them with a protective order, but we help every person who comes to a wearer with a safety plan. Because you got to have a plan for safety. It's mm-hmm. It's not just the restraining order. You know, that's one part of a plan, but there needs to be a bigger plan. And with a restraining order, she's not as responsible. She's never responsible for his behavior, but not only is she not responsible, but law enforcement can step in.
Okay.
So in his behavior, if he breaks the restraining order, law enforcement is there to help.
In order to break the cycle of domestic violence, well, staying at your shelter are women and children. And how do you break that cycle? How can a woman transform herself with the help of others or help of any therapeutic intervention to really not repeat choosing an abusive partner or going back to the same abusive partner? So what do you do at the shelter with women?
We provide trauma-informed care for people and services. You know,
trauma-informed.
Living with violence is a traumatic experience.
Totally.
And, you know, people, as you talked about brain development and how brains are transformed by living with violence, that's because you're living with trauma on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to break that down for people and just provide safe, calm space where they can just be.
Mm-hmm. So just the whole environment, which for the first time in their life could be a place where nobody's yelling and screaming and there isn't chaos.
Right. That's right. Because aware needs to be safe for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to start with that.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who listen and offer support
mm-hmm.
and advocacy. We don't tell people what to do. You know, women who are coming to aware have been told what to do and how to do it and how long to do it and how high to do it. And so it's a choice for each woman. So then she's taking responsibility
mm-hmm.
for herself.
Uh-huh.
We're not doing that. We can lay out what the possibilities are as we understand them or, you know, help identify options. We don't decide on the options.
Is it a prerequisite of being at the shelter that a woman engages in some of this therapeutic work?
You know, not necessarily. We have expectations that people participate in our programming,
mm-hmm.
which is meeting with an advocate, meeting, coming to support groups and education groups, having
mm-hmm.
kids participate. That being said, we also recognize that everybody has their own pace.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never trusted anyone in your life, why on earth are you going to come to us and,
yeah.
you know, spill your heart?
Mm-hmm.
But over time, you might come to trust and to talk and to rebuild over time.
I mean, do you know of many success stories?
Yes. In fact, one of my coworkers says, Sarah Lynn, I think we should have in our newsletter, and I happen to agree with her, success stories. Like women who are able and willing to talk about where they've been and where they are.
Like Karen Robinson.
Well, there you go.
She's public about that.
Yes.
And she's the founder of the Aware Shelter, and she came from a background, and she's spoken publicly about this, of domestic violence.
Right, with a partner.
With a partner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Who held the gun? Right, I heard that. We have staff retreats annually, and about every other year we ask her to come to give the background. And, she's very inspirational.
Uh-huh. But so there are enough women who have left abusive relationships and have formed a healthy life after being at the Aware Shelter.
Right.
That you could have them come in and tell their stories. You know, I told you I'm friends with Jenny McCarthy, who wrote the quintessential sort of book for victims of domestic violence. But she also wrote a book called The Ones Who Got Away. Do you remember that book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
So it could be a similar, that would be a wonderful thing to do.
It would, wouldn't
because
it?
Because it's so inspiring, and it gives you a role model.
Right.
And also, that would partly be, I would think at the shelter, there'd be a support group. Women would meet as a group to share ideas on how they can start their new life. One of the interesting things, I used to be hired by AWARE in the old days to lead groups for incest survivors. And one of the reasons group therapy really is preferable to individual therapy is as women heard the stories of others who had been sexually abused as children, they were outraged. But they weren't out. But one aspect of psychological damage is that you often blame yourself for being sexually abused as a child,
right,
even though the person who abused you is an adult.
Right.
So they would be outraged about other women, and then we would talk about, well, what about you?
Right.
So in that way, when women are in the group and hear the story of other women being hurt, they say, you shouldn't put up with that, sister. Oh, well, I think we're really quickly running out of time. It went really fast, and there's a couple of more songs Sarah Lynn picked out for us, but we're not going to have time to play them. Sarah Lynn, I really want to thank you for coming in tonight, and maybe because I'm only halfway through the items that I wanted to talk about, you know, we'll let 6 months or so go by and see if you could come up and we can do a follow-up.
That's
okay?
Very kind. Thank you, Elaine.
But thank you for your insights this evening and your excellent clinical knowledge. And I also want to thank John and Dolly Kramers, who've been by our side here, our loyal technical support team, and who I should have gotten on the air, especially Dolly, because she had a lot to say about this issue, in the news and had some good questions. So they keep the board side of this program flowing. So I'd like to say goodnight to our Southeast Alaska listeners. Please tune in next month, Monday, July 1st, at 7 p.m. on K2 for Mind Over Matter. Good night, folks.